And I was always the person that said, hey, I'm behind the scenes. I'm a publicist. I don't have to do a media interview. I don't need to be in a photo. It's all about the client. But I was definitely hiding behind the fact that I was just terrified of having to be in front of the media and do an interview like this or take a photo. It was, you know, me putting my guard up.
And that was me. It's a reverse podcast this week. Yes, that's right. I'm in the hot seat and you're listening to the Influence Unlocked podcast.
And I'm your host, Samantha Dyback, the founder and CEO of the PR Hub. This is a podcast dedicated to taking you behind the scenes of what it takes to really grow a brand, get an insight into the world of public relations, and show you how to harness your own power of influence. Whether you're looking to kickstart your own personal brand, want to learn more about what goes into building a great business, develop your leadership skills, or simply find inspiration for your own success, then you're in the right place. Join me in conversation with some of Australia's brightest entrepreneurs, industry leaders and change makers as we go beyond the news headlines and highlight reels to explore the highs and lows of their journeys and understand what makes them tick. Get ready to unlock your influence.
Welcome back to the Influence Unlocked podcast. Now, I know for my regular listeners, it's been a while since the last show went to air. And I want to say thank you to those of you who've actually been reaching out and asking me when I'd be back. It really does mean a lot. And I've really missed recording the show. I don't know, what can I say? Somehow running a business, being a mum, life has just somehow taken over this year and it's almost Christmas. Anyway, I'm really excited to be back and with an episode where we've done things a little differently. This time, it's my turn in the hot seat. So in this episode, I'm interviewed by my longtime client and more importantly, dear friend, the absolutely amazing, inspiring and unstoppable Taryn Williams, an award-winning founder, brand ambassador, board director and business advisor. In this episode, Taryn asks me about some of the most defining moments in my life, those that have shaped and impacted who I am today. And surprisingly, we get quite deep and personal on some topics. I guess only surprising because I'm not used to sharing so much about my personal journey. However, I felt super comfortable sharing with you all and hope that some of the things we cover might resonate or even be useful. We also delve into the topics of entrepreneurship, personal branding, and public relations with some more practical advice for those of you who might be business owners or thought leaders in your industries looking to hear more. As nervous as I was going into the chat, I actually really enjoyed the opportunity to sit on the other side of the interview and share some of my story. So I hope you enjoy it too. And don't forget, if you enjoyed the episode, you like the podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app, leave a review so more great people like you have the opportunity to listen in to the podcast. Now over to Taryn.
Well, thank you so much for having me and letting me put you in the hot seat for a change.
I guess I was due for it. I've been due for it for a while. So yes, thank you for being here.
Let's get straight into it. So I want to kick off with the first question. What is your one word for the day and why?
So weird sitting here. I'm used to asking that question. And everybody looks at me and goes, one word. My one word for the day is meditation.
Okay. I would not have picked that coming from you. What is this? I think I know you pretty well. Is this a new thing? Is this a new practice? Tell me why meditation, or is this a aspirational, if I say it, then maybe I will become a meditator?
I'm still on my journey, and usually people will talk about how they're feeling for that one word of the day. So it is a little bit different for this show. I say meditation because I recently started practicing or learning Vedic meditation. So I actually spoke to one of our clients, Nico Plowman, on the show a couple episodes ago earlier this season. He's a Vedic meditation teacher. Wow. You know, when I first met Nico, gosh, almost a year ago, I was completely blown away, not only by his presence, but also what he had to say about how Vedic meditation had changed his life. And in the podcast chat he had with me, he talked very much about life before and after meditation. So it's something that I have been curious about ever since, and something that I felt, you know, at my stage in my life, and I don't like to use the word busy. We all have lots of different things going on in our personal lives, in business, you know, with ourselves as well. For me, for a while now, I've been thinking about what is it that I can do for me that I can do on a daily basis that I don't need to go and I guess Nico calls it importing happiness. Or, I love that. Which it is great, and now I use that quite a lot. So it's like, what can I do? It's not shopping, it's not holidays, it's how do I center myself? So I embarked on a personal course with Nico and still very much in that journey. But yes, I'm practicing meditation 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon without fail. I'm totally committed to this, and it's very much front of mind for me right now.
That is impressive. I will check in on you in 6 months' time and see if you are sticking to this 20 minutes start of day and end of day, because I know how much you have on your plate. So props to you if you can continue it. I've got every excuse under the sun why I can't fit meditation into my life, and I know it absolutely benefits every single person I know who has done it, and some of the most inspiring, brilliant people in my life meditate. So maybe I can catch it through osmosis from you.
Maybe I can get you on the journey. But I'm still very new to it. But so far, I think it's a bit like fitness. You know, I make sure that I get that into my week regularly. Sometimes I don't want to do it. Same thing with meditation, but I was up this morning and I'd been to bed really late last night, and I was like, no, you've got to get up and do it. So let's see how it goes.
Okay, fingers crossed for you.
Yes.
Okay, next, I want to get you to take me back to when you were 15 years old. Teenage Sam. Do you think if you caught up with that little young Sam today, would she be surprised at where you are and how you've turned out?
I was going to sit on the fence on this one. Obviously, yeah. I knew the question that was coming, so I've given it a bit of thought. For the most, and I probably still am, but for the most part, I don't think she would have been surprised. As a 15-year-old, I was pretty straight at school. By that stage, I was doing really well at school academically, and I was involved in a lot of extracurricular activities. But I was the eldest of four children, I still am. And I was also a bit of a rebel, but in a different way. So I didn't drink or do drugs or sneak out to parties, but I always had this sense of, I don't want to be here. I don't want to hang around with my family. I'm way better than that. I want to skip forward to age 30, and I want to be in business, and I'm going to be amazing. And so in the back of my mind, that was very much there. I think maybe she did meet me. Maybe she would be a little bit disappointed that I haven't done as well as maybe 15-year-old Sam thought she would do.
Oh my God, what did 15-year-old Sam think she was going
to
do?
I have to say she was very naive. So she had no idea what business was, or I think I had an aspiration to be earning 100K. A year by the time I was 30. So I had no idea about anything back then. But for the most part, you know, that 15-year-old, and we can talk about this a little bit later, there was a lot going on for her that people didn't see, a lot going on in the background. And I think that she would be happy to see that there's certain parts of things that were troubling me at that time, and that were, you know, challenges for me at that time, have now, I've been able to work through that, and they no longer exist.
Yeah, it's impressive. I think one of the things you and I have talked about a bit in the past is that we're probably both pretty doggedly determined kids and pretty strong-willed and maybe a little bit challenging for our parents. Do you think that spirit, that grittiness and tenacity, do you think that served you in the person that you've become and helped you in your journey into business? Or do you think it was something that hindered you, maybe stood in your way of maybe receiving advice or taking on board feedback from others?
I was always really determined to achieve something. As I said, I was really naive if I look back at it. I didn't know what that was.
Blissful naivety of youth.
Yes, and I've heard you say that many times in interviews, and I borrow it occasionally. I mean, I remember 15-year-old me on the outside. I was very straight and I did very well, and I looked like a great kid. But I also remember, you know, we were on a holiday once in the Gold Coast and I gave my parents hell. To the point where they put me on a flight. I didn't want to be there. I went through this period of just not wanting to be anywhere near my family because I was too cool for them. And so they ended up.
Teenagers are awful, aren't they? I was awful. I apologize to my parents if they're listening to this because I was truly dreadful.
Yeah, I mean, as a mother now, it horrifies me, some of my behaviour. But they
at
put me on.
At least you're going to get your own back. You know, she will give it to you in spades. I'm sure she will return the favour, Misha.
She's already doing it. She's six. But they put me on a flight back from the Gold Coast to Sydney to my grandparents when I was about 15, because I was just being such a brat. And they were like, okay, you don't want to be here. We'll put you back. And so I did that. But I think also I still had a capacity to listen and to want to learn from others, because I knew that there was a lot that I didn't know. Over time, I've gotten better at that. Yes, it definitely helped. But yeah, I think, you know, I'm much more open to advice now than I was back then.
Mm. So, just staying on that theme of being a bit reflective, what are some of the key pivotal moments in your life and career that have really gone on to shape who you are? Like, what are the three biggest, if you had to name just three, defining moments in your career that really shaped who you are today?
Big question. Let's start with something. I've spoken about this a little bit, but not too much really. So when I was 13, I developed an eating disorder, and that stayed with me for close to 20 years.
God.
So I can do the maths. And I still, so it's not really like an actual moment in time. It's a moment, but also a very big chunk period of my life, which is sometimes it's hard to reflect.
And really formative years too.
Yeah, you know, like I grew up as, and you know, when I tell people this again, they're like, really? Are you sure? Like I was one of four kids. I was the eldest. I was always overweight and, you know, on the chubby side growing up as a kid, and was tormented a lot growing up in primary school and then high school, and always had issues around the fact that I never really felt like I fit in, like I was never part of the cool group, and I got teased a lot for having that extra weight and was really self-conscious about it. I don't think that that's totally the reason why I developed an eating disorder. A lot of things go into that. It's a disease, but a lot of psychological things and other factors go into that. But I still remember the day that, you know, if it start like it first happened, and I was 13. It was Christmas Day. We were at our family friend's place for Christmas lunch, and they had a massive house, and so there were lots of different levels and different bathrooms, and I don't know what it was, but the next thing I found myself in the downstairs toilet, like, you know, putting my fingers down my throat and throwing up. And it sort of, I'd say evolved probably isn't the right word, but it just continued on from there. And so it was a really long journey. It was, you know, I was saying before that there were things going on for me as a 15-year-old that on the outside I looked like I had my shit together. I was doing really well at school. I did well in extracurricular activities. I even started to lose some of that, you know, that weight that carried me through and through high school. You know, I was teased a lot. But by that stage, it just become so ingrained in my behaviour, and I'm a very habitual person. So it was a defining moment for me because my whole life was centred around this obsession. It's when you have an addiction, and anyone who has an addiction or, you know, had that in their life, it's so compulsive that you want to stop, but you just can't stop. But I used to centre a lot of my life around that. And from as a teenager, things would revolve around that because you couldn't do anything but like give in to the urge. But on the outside, I had everything, you know, everything was going on really well for me. And so it was very internal that I hid a lot of that stuff. And I think it really, you know, it damaged my self-confidence because you feel very guilty and you feel very ashamed. You feel very ashamed. And I think back then as well, like we've learned so much in the however many years it's been since I was a teenager. Around what it means to have an eating disorder, and that it's not just about being greedy or being selfish, but there's a lot of other things attached to that because somebody has stuff going on. But for me at that time, there was a lot of shame associated with it, and I just didn't know how to break out of it. And my parents did try. They'd take me to all sorts of psychologists and places to try and overcome it. But like, as I said, it stayed with me in various shapes of like eating disorders and anorexia for a long time. Until my early 30s. So that's the first one. And I tend to gloss over it a bit now because I feel quite removed from it. Like it's something that was such a big part of my life and now it's not. But I also know that I have to manage the way that I eat things and you know, I would have triggers if I haven't. But now at least I can eat a burger. Mm-hmm. Like, or, you know, pizza is one of my favourite foods. You know, I could never allow myself to eat that stuff before. So now I know how to eat and when to eat and I can eat those things comfortably. And that's a great relief and I guess great joy in my life.
Second, do you think it's ironic that you've ended up in an industry that is, I guess, in some ways sort of focused on image, you know, being in PR and media, especially talking about things like personal brand. Obviously my industry a little bit more so, like obviously models and actors and influencers, but certainly sort of PR marketing is very much about sort of image and perception. Do you think it's sort of ironic and do you think that that has sort of added an additional weight to you coming into this industry? Or do you think it's something that's benefited you in that you are very aware of some of the underlying triggers in maybe how people might be perceived or have the fear of being perceived and how that might shape them as business leaders?
Yeah, I think certainly like in our industry, working in our industry, there is, and personal brand, it's all about, I guess, perception and what you look like. But I always talk about being really authentic with personal brand and looking and presenting yourself in a way that you feel comfortable with. I went through a period where a business I was involved with ended really badly, and it was a big toll on me. And I just decided corporate and business world was all over. And I decided to go and be a fitness instructor and start a personal training business, which at the time, you know, I still was going through my eating disorder issues. So that wasn't a great place. I don't think it was a great choice. But, you know, coming back to our industry, I think it's really important to, you know, I think it's important to present well. I don't feel the pressures that I used to feel in and around appearance. And maybe that's just an age thing as well. You get more comfortable. They say, you know, you get more comfortable. Of course, I still worry about how I look. You know, I like to stay fit and go to the gym, and I like to wear nice clothes, and get my hair done and makeup done occasionally. But I also don't feel as pressured these days to worry if, you know, maybe there is a little bit of extra, like, I don't know, fat or something on certain body parts. That's just an example that I did when I was much younger.
Maybe more comfortable in your own skin and more about image being for you instead of for others, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I you know, I like to look good for myself. That's something that's important to me. I still remember as a kid, like I was 7 or 8, and I remember digging into my mom and like having a go at what she was wearing and how she was really daggy, and I wish she looked like all the other mums. And it was such a horrible thing to say to my mom. I've said some really awful things to my parents.
We both apologize to our parents for everything that we put them through.
But my mum was, you know, I was looking at photos the other day at my grandmother's house, and, you know, I was probably only about 8, maybe it was around that time. And mum was gorgeous. Like, she was beautiful. Her hair was done and makeup was done. We were going to a wedding. But she just looked great. And I just thought, oh, yeah, like, that's probably where some of that comes from.
Don't think you're getting out of the other two. So there was 3 formative moments that I wanted to talk about. So you've got through one. Give me the other two.
Okay. All right. Second one I am going to say was the first time I fell pregnant, and that was about, I think, 9 years ago now. I was always on this path where I'd convinced myself and was very clear and adamant that I didn't want children. And I was in my early 30s, and the business was just starting to build and starting to take off, and I'd really found my feet, like, in the foundations of what the PR Hub is today. And I do believe that part of that was me subconsciously, like, you know, me sort of preempting that I didn't think that I'd be able to have kids because of all my eating disorders and what had happened and how much I had damaged my body for nearly 20 years. I'd been told that it's probably was not likely that I'd ever be able to have a baby. And so I think part of me, which I'm really good at, is going straight into defense, like shut down mode. I shut things out if I think it's going to damage me. And so that was my line. I fell pregnant, wasn't planning it, and I was with my partner at the time. And I remember spending the next 2 days crying, not because I was happy. I was just like, how can this be happening? It's ruining my life. Like, I've got this business. I don't want to do this. Anyway, fast forward to the end of the first trimester, the 12, 13 week mark. I had adjusted to the idea of it by then. And we did the tests and the scans, and we went in, and the doctors were like, okay, you got to come and sit down, and, you know, we need to talk to you.
Oh, God.
And they sat us down, and I was none the wiser. And they said, look, you know, we've done those initial 12-week scans, and your baby seems to have what we call trisomy 13, which is a rare genetic disorder. And so we were like, oh, and typical me, I was like, right, okay, let's go and get it done. Let's get rid of it. Like, because this was some of the advice again, that they were telling us. And I remember Ian and I thought, you know, it did cause a little bit of tension between us, because I'm really good at shutting down in those moments and trying to compartmentalize and move on. But it was devastating. And we went through the next week, just was an absolute blur. We had to do more tests. They were pretty adamant that what they'd found was right. And, you know, trisomy 13, for anyone listening, it essentially means that, like, a baby is born with really heavy physical defects and like disability. And most babies don't either last, or they're stillborn, or they might last for a few weeks. Or I think I'd read something once that maybe the eldest child with trisomy 13 got to 10, but it's not a nice life. And so we spent the next week doing more tests, and I remember on the Friday night, which was a week later, the doctor calling me on the phone with the results of these tests, and I was on my own, and he was just like, look, I don't say this lightly, but our medical advice is that you terminate the pregnancy. And I really don't want you listening to any outside voices. Don't want you Googling from a doctor's advice and doctor's perspective. He was like, you know, don't let any nurse, if you come across a nurse in the hospital, like I just, this is my advice, and you need to terminate. And I remember just sitting down on the floor in the dark, and I don't know where Ian was. I think he was at work, just bawling my eyes out. So I'd gone from like this person who didn't want a baby to realizing the value of life, I guess. And you know, something was growing inside me, and getting this advice that we had to terminate. And we did. And it was really hard. And for a long time, for years, I sort of beat myself up every time I saw a kid that, you know, that maybe had like some sort of genetic disorder, was clearly like affected. I'd be like, why did I think I was special? Why did I decide to make that decision? You know, why these people obviously seem a lot stronger than me because they've gone through with these pregnancies, all crazy dumb stuff like that. And we fought the weekend before because Ian was, he was Googling and he was being really hopeful. And I was like, nah, like there is no hope. So it was so hard. It was so hard. Our families came in, you know, and to let her go, because she was, you know, we used to call her Broggy. But it also inspired me to then think, actually, I want to have a child. So, you know, the silver lining of that was something that I never thought was possible and had set my mind on not doing, that it turned me around.
Thank you for sharing that story, because I can't imagine how incredibly traumatic that would be to go through. And also that it doesn't have to be something that is a conversation killer. You know, it's something that we should be able to talk about without it becoming this heavy elephant in the room.
There's, and so many women have different stories. Mm. You know, it's not, that was not my first story, not my last. I mean, it was my first, but not my last. But so many women have those stories. And, you know, now we've got conversations going around. Some employers are providing leave, you know, for miscarriages. And I can absolutely see why, you know, like, because even since then, you know, and I've had other challenges around that. You know, I've been pregnant 5 times. It really does, it does take a lot out of you, and you don't at the time. And you know, I try to be resilient, and I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing, but it's still something that, you know, we're human at the end of the day, and to try and shy away from that is, I don't think it's the best thing to do. It's not in anyone's best interest, but yeah.
What do you think of the word resilient? I think people have really conflicted opinions about whether it's a nice adjective, whether it really truly aptly describes them, whether it's something that they want to be described as. I think anyone who is described as resilient obviously generally means they've had to overcome a lot of adversity, most of the things that they wouldn't have chosen to have in their life if they could choose differently. Would you describe yourself as resilient, and how does the word make you feel?
I think it's always tough when you go to say things about yourself. It's easy to go to the really negative things. It's easy to deflect to that. But resilient, do I think I'm resilient? I try to be resilient. I'd say I do pretty well at that, but I think it can also work against my favour sometimes, because I am good at shutting things down and looking like I'm moving on from things, but do I really? I'm not sure. And I think this is partly why I'm sort of going down that meditation pathway, is to work on my inner self and work on healing and work on being able to deal better in situations. And everybody has crap in their lives, like things that you don't necessarily hear about. You know, like my dad, you know, my dad passed away very suddenly 6 months ago. And I only just started thinking about that and thinking, if I hadn't been running a business, then I probably would have tried to take at least a month off to try and process and deal with that. But, you know, as a business owner, you also have a responsibility to, you know, you take that on, you've got to be a leader, you've got to be there. So I think there's a resilience piece in there. And being a mum, which actually I've jumped to my third one, but there's also, you know, another learning and another reason for being resilient in life.
And so that's your third most formative thing that happened to you?
That is my third. Maybe bigger than the other two, I don't know. Like it's the most recent. So I mentioned that I've been pregnant 5 times. So Mish was my third, and actually I was my mum's third too. So we're both born on the same day. So I had a miscarriage, missed miscarriage 4 months after I lost the first one. And so then by that stage, I was on this like, no, I've got to try. I'm not stopping until I fall pregnant. And you find like with most things in life, if you get too obsessed or too hung up with things, they don't happen. So then we were like, no, we're just going to relax. Anyway, I fell pregnant with Misha and I was a bit more like, oh yeah, well, let's just see if this one works. Let's just see if we actually get to the end and she comes out okay. We had an obstetrician, so everything was fine. But there was always this, well, I don't like to get too excited about anything in life. So let's just see if she comes out. And I found out, I hate surprises. So I found out very early on that she was a girl. And then she just, you know, she came into the world. She was induced and it just happened to coincide with my birthday. So she was born on my birthday, which is a beautiful, beautiful experience to actually share that with her. But I really, and again, you will remember this, I had no idea. I was completely ignorant about what motherhood would entail. I was a business owner. I had a baby. It was my life. And this little thing that was coming was just going to fit in and around it. And I was planning to get to Melbourne the week after she was born to an event where a minister was opening an office for a client. And then she was born and I hated, like, or hate's a strong word actually. I didn't know how to embrace motherhood. And I think that's very common now that from having spoken to people. But for me, it was so foreign and all I wanted to do was get back to work in my mind. And here was this little thing that all of a sudden I couldn't like switch off. Like she was just going to be there and I had no idea what to do with her. So that was very confronting because I'm all about control. You know, as a business owner, like it's no secret that we like to control and be in charge of things and know how to steer a ship. So she changed my life a lot for the first 6 to 12 months. It was super hard. I've spoken about this before on panels at events. Like I just really disliked being a mum. I used to say hate, but it's probably a bit the wrong word. Disliked it. It was such a disruption to my life. I really didn't deal with it very well. I wanted to put her into daycare as soon as I can. Like I just wanted to get back to work. And it's, you know, I think it's taken me a few years to realise just how extraordinary a gift it is to be a mum and not everybody gets that opportunity. And yeah, sure, you know, like I've been pregnant a couple of times since and again, like neither of those were successful. And we talk about that quite openly because sometimes she's like, well, why am I an only child? Like what's going on there? But she's been an extraordinary gift. She torments me every day and I torment her. I think it's a star sign thing as well. But she has, it's taught me a lot about trying to be a little bit calmer and a little bit more patient, which does flow into business.
Yeah, I want to dig into that a little bit because I vividly remember this period. I feel like I had a front row seat to this experience.
We're going to put her under the office desk. Remember, just bring her into the office.
I remember this. I mean, you were like 9 months pregnant. I think you were giving birth the next week and you were still coming to events with me, looking fabulous, high heels, makeup done, like from behind, no one would be able to tell you were pregnant. You were tiny and you had this cute belly. And I was convinced that you would, like, I think I remember saying to you, just take her to the gym with you. Just pop her in the carrier in the corner. She'll be fine. She'll sleep through. Like, I feel like maybe I fed some of this this belief that everything would be fine. You'd be back at work the next week. So on reflection, obviously the experience was very, very different for you. What do you wish you'd known at the time that you know now? And I think you've spoken very openly about that first sort of 6 to 12 months of really not enjoying the experience and I think the lack of control that comes with that. And I'll speak honestly, I'm a control freak. I think, you know, you may fall in the same classification. What made the change from that, you know, whether it was 6 to 12 month mark, was it how much she'd developed and that you felt more connection to her, or was it a mindset shift in you saying, I actually really want to enjoy this experience? Or what made you change that view of motherhood?
I mean, what I would do differently or what I would say I've learnt from that period is that firstly take maternity leave, proper maternity leave. And
how does that work as a business owner?
Well, I think it's about where you're at in that. Yeah. And I did have a couple of people working in my business at the time, but not, it wasn't, and I tried to set it up so that I could take that time off, but it is very, very hard, especially as, you know, as a woman, I think it is different. And I just have to look at, you know, the types of clients we have now at the PR Hub. The majority of them are male-led businesses. Yeah. And I think it's at what point is that business? Those businesses are much bigger, and it's not me saying, you know, it's right or wrong around the gender piece, but as a mum, you do have certain things. You have, you know, you do breastfeed and they naturally come to you. But I didn't go to mother's groups. I was just really ill-informed in my own head in and around the experience and also you can't get that stuff back. And so for me, it's like I'd be like definitely if I ever was going to do it again is to stop and embrace it. And life's not all about business. And I think that's probably the biggest learning that's come out of all of this. And you know, you've had a different experience, but it's sort of similar learnings is that as founders, you get so attached to your business and wanting to succeed and you love the growth and you love the excitement of, you know, building and what happens. Having said that though, you know, like as she's gotten older, we obviously can engage. Mm-hmm. And I've treated her like an adult from a very young age. And again, it was just a lot of ignorance on my part as a mom and just seeing her like not intentionally, but almost as like another person or another thing in business. Like why would she not know this? And so it's been a real period of growth for me in that journey.
My fear through, so I'm obviously going through a sort of bit of a career transition at the moment. You know, I have enough of a sort of loss of who I am at the moment going through who am I not as, you know, founder and CEO of my second company. What will I be after this? What do I enjoy? What do I love? Let alone I can imagine throwing motherhood into that. Who am I as a mother? And is that something that you experienced, this doubt, who am I, loss of identity, identity crisis kind of piece?
Yeah, absolutely. Like it was just horrible. It was just and
you are when really you speak, selling it to me.
not doing a very good job on that, am I? It's actually like it's funny. We joke it at work amongst the team because there's a few of us who are mums, and we talk about our kids, and the rest of the team are like, "Yep, you guys are totally turning us off becoming mums." Yeah, look, it was just really hard, you know, and it also showed me, I guess, that I have attached a lot of my sense of self-worth and who I am. I identify with my business and I still struggle with that sometimes. I think, yeah, for me, all sense of identity is tricky. And you'll speak to, I think if you speak to most first-time mums, they will tell you a very similar type of story, is that it completely changes who you are. All of a sudden you become this, you know, I used to think you're like the vehicle that they just like there and they're like hanging off your boobs and then you got to change their nappies and then I'm selling it again, right? Yeah. Just I think the best thing in that situation and my advice to me if I was to do it again is, and it's hard to take the advice when you're there, is just take the time. It'll go really fast. Try and enjoy the experience because then they grow and they get older and then at some point they don't want to hang out with you anymore, which I'm not there yet, which is really nice.
I know, but it still seems like just yesterday to me. And now when I see Misha, I'm like, oh my gosh, you are a giant human being. Like you have full personality and it's mind boggling to me. So I can't imagine how quickly it's flown by for you as her mother. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your team too, who I have had the pleasure of working with over the last, 8 years, who I think are obviously incredible people and incredibly skilled. And one of the things they're very, very good at and that you taught me was all about this idea of developing personal brand. And I steadfastly refused to get involved in that when you first explained the concept to me. And I was like, I don't need that. Why would I want that? That sounds exhausting. I'm not a media personality. I'm not a celebrity. Why do I need a personal brand? And I remember you saying to me, you have a personal brand whether or not you choose to control it. So if you either get to set the narrative, you either get to decide what that narrative is, or the media or the press or your colleagues or your investors are going to do that for you. And as soon as I sort of heard that, I was like, okay, this is different to what I thought it was. And I really need to start thinking about how I show up in this world and what that looks like. And I think your team are exceptional at this. And I wanted to ask you, given I think you think your team are as exceptional as I think they are, if I had to ask them, what is the personal brand of Samantha Dieback? What do you think they would say? If they had to succinctly pitch me as a journalist, the Samantha Dieback brand, what would they say?
She's putting me on the spot now. Yes, all the things that you said are true in and around, I guess, what people's hesitancies or founders' hesitancies around personal brand. But you know I love talking about personal brand, and obviously I was talking to you about it 8 years ago, and it's something that, and I'm not avoiding your question, but it's something that I actually learned about very early on in my career. So it was my first job working for an Australian company called NADS Hair Removal Gel. And little did I realize, but it was exactly what we do now in our business, which is work with founders who have amazing products, services, solving real problems and helping them just understand, well, what's their role in that? So like, where do they sit? What's their unique point of difference? Why did they start the business? Why will people buy into their story? And then leveraging that to then showcase the brand or the product or the service. Oh, I don't know if you're asking me if my team are going to pitch me or what is my personal brand. I guess my personal brand it's been quite organic. It's definitely been organic. It hasn't been something where I sat down one day and went, right, this is what I'm going to look like. These are the sorts of clothes I'm going to wear. These are the sorts of events I'm going to go to. These are the things I'm going to comment on in the media. But in terms of, I guess, my thought leadership,
can we just talk about how ironic that is for a minute? This is like how plumbers always have the worst plumbing at home, right? Like, you are an expert in this space and yet you'd never sort of conceived the idea that you needed to do this for yourself. Is that how it happened?
It took me a long time to accept it. I remember when I realized it needed to happen, and I think maybe it was 2017. And I was always the person that said, hey, I'm behind the scenes. I'm a publicist. I don't have to do a media interview. I don't need to be in a photo. It's all about the clients. And that was, I don't necessarily disagree with that now. But I was definitely hiding behind the fact that I was just terrified of having to be in front of the media and do an interview like this or take a photo. It was, you know, me putting my guard up. And I was in Hawaii on a family holiday, where some of my best ideas come from on holidays. And I was thinking about the business more broadly and how do I grow the business and, you know, what's the next step for the business? And something just clicked and I thought, I really need to do a photo shoot and I really need to get a bio and I probably should be doing all the things that I keep telling, and business wasn't very, very big at this stage. All the things I was telling you that you needed to do in order to build a personal brand, and it just felt really icky and really uncomfortable for me. I speak to most of our founders now who come to the business, and none of them are that different. So I look at my personal brand now, and it continues to evolve. It is very much centered around what we do at the PR Hub, because I am the spokesperson for our business, just like, I'd expect a founder of any other business to be the spokesperson and to be quite articulate in the topics in and around what the business does. So I'd like to think that they would say that I am have a reasonable level of expertise when it comes to anything to do with branding or marketing or personal branding or even business strategy and how that plays into a broader comms piece. That's very much sort of where I sit now from a business perspective. But it's definitely never contrived. And I think that's the worst way to go with personal brand, is to create something you think that others need.
I couldn't agree more. And I think once I overcame that same ick, nerves and fear, and I think misunderstanding about what this concept of personal brand actually is, I think once I overcame that, I think it's obviously benefited my career and my businesses in so many ways. And I always say to people, it's so easy now for me to identify opportunities that are suitable for me, but also for those opportunities to know exactly whether or not I will be the right fit for what they want to do. And so it's streamlined so many things. I can easily identify what aligns with my core values, what's on brand for me. It really takes so much of the guesswork out of, which boards to join, which events to speak at, what's really going to benefit my companies. It's just so beneficial. So I couldn't agree more. That said, personal branding can have a downside. And I think that there's probably some examples you could give us, being an expert in this space, of when it does go wrong, whether it's either personal branding example where it's just so contrived that you're like, God, that feels fake and awful, or when it goes just horribly wrong where someone just really doesn't live to that sort of personal brand or those values. I find this really interesting because I can imagine being in this as a professional, having to navigate those times where something like that does happen would be incredibly challenging. So I would love to hear from you. Any examples of what that does look like when personal branding goes wrong, or any sort of things to avoid?
It's really important to remember that once you put yourself out there in the media, and we all kind of do it if we've got a social media presence, so you don't have to be a business owner or somebody who is on TV or on radio. You could be anyone. Once you put yourself out there, you're projecting and you're putting out a personal brand. I guess then the next step is thinking about, well, what do you want others to see? Like, what do you want people to remember you as or remember you by? And if you are in the media, then you do have that extra attention on you, and you have a responsibility to yourself and sometimes to sponsors as well, like sponsors, partners, team, if you're leading a team, to live up to what you put out in the media. I mean, when we talk about, it's not so much doing personal brand wrong, but when you do have a media profile and then you very publicly do something that contradicts the brand that you've built and that people know you for, it does start to come unstuck. And I know, just thinking off the top of my head, like recently in Australia, like I think I was overseas at the time, but I remember seeing the press and there was this whole kerfuffle with Michael Clarke, the former Australian cricketer, and Karl Stefanovic from the Today Show. And I was reading it going, what? Like, how does that even happen? Like, you know, and we have high expectations of these people, that high profile people, be it celebrities, sporting identities, TV people. We hold them up to account. Like, that's, and that very much played out in the media too, following that. Like, you know, Michael Clarke got a lot of backlash in the press around a video, and it's been really conscious of the fact that anyone can turn up and take a video or something and send it to a news outlet or put it on social media, and look what happens, right? You know, sponsors pull out, opportunities go, you know, go awry and stuff. So I think it's personal brand, you sort of always need to be on. That's the thing. Once you're out there, it always needs to be on. But again, not in a contrived way, but in a way that, you know, the way that you've built it and a way that people resonate with, so you don't lose what you've built, I guess.
Yeah. Before we get into the last segment, and you touched a little bit on holidays just then, in all this spare time you have between, you know you work out religiously, which I absolutely admire for a busy businesswoman and single parent. And between that, between running businesses, between, you know, all of your speaking engagements, putting together this podcast, what do you do to wind down? Or is that meditation now? Is meditation going to take up all of your time? Or how do you wind down? How do you disconnect? What does that look like for you?
Well, meditation is, what is it, 40 minutes a day now? No, well, so that's all very new. So I would say coming back to that, you made a comment about me religiously working out. I'd like to think I do. I'm pretty consistent. I'm somebody who likes to stay consistent. I think, you know, talking about the meditation thing, I don't want to miss it because I hold myself accountable to stuff, and no one gets more disappointed if something doesn't happen because I've like not done it than me. So I like to, I guess I do, you know, I go to the gym, try to go 3 times a week, and that is part of, I guess, unwinding. I don't find it particularly relaxing. It's not something that I absolutely love. It might look like that on social media, but it's something that I do because I know it's good for me, and I know that I feel good afterwards, and I know that, you know, I like to stay fit. So I'm not sure that it helps me unwind. I like going to art galleries. I don't go nearly enough, but my daughter actually really got me into art, because she wants to be an artist when she gets older, and that's one of her things. And so I was trying to find ways to connect with her, and since having done that in the past couple of years, I love going to art galleries. There's something about being in an art gallery, and you would know this because you love doing it as well. It does help my mind. It calms me down a little bit. So I love that. I love Aboriginal art in particular, and being in Aboriginal art galleries. I love music. I love going out for dinners and drinks. I don't do very much of it, but I do love a great restaurant, and I love a great couple glasses of wine. That's really exciting to me. We can talk about travel later. What else do I do? Not enough. You know, sometimes, you know, people often say to me, like, how do you fit it all in? Like, I see you on social media and I know you from work, and you just seem to be doing everything, and you're always everywhere, and like you never stop. And that makes me feel like cringe on the inside because I don't fit it all in. And social media is a part of what you see of my life, not all of it. So for me, my response is usually it's my personal life and my downtime that suffers, that misses out, because for me it's very much about business, it's about Misha, and it's about my family. And so then the personal thing kind of, like, I've got to get better at that totally.
Yes, and I feel like I nag you about this regularly, and I do think that you have an incredibly incredible work ethic, and I know that you've been through some really, really challenging situations in the last 6-12 months, and the fact that you show up every single day for your daughter, for your staff, for your team, for your clients, there's been a number of times where I'm like, really, you don't think you should take today off? Or like, hey, how about you skip the gym, sleep in, and, you know, take the day off? Or, and I think it's incredible. Okay, well, it's time to get into the last segment, which I know you know well, 5 in 5. So 5 questions in 5 minutes. You've got 60 seconds to answer them. So quick responses, please. You've got to put many people in this hot seat. Now I'm going to do it to you. So first up, easy one, holidays. Do you believe in taking holidays? When, how often? What does the dream holiday look like for you?
Absolutely take holidays. I mentioned it before. Great time to switch off, although I say that I never completely really switch off from business unless it's over that Christmas New Year period, because there's always something going on, and, you know, as a business founder, I always want to be connected, but generally like to use, I'm talking about business already. it's terrible, isn't it?
How's that holiday thing working out for you, Sam?
Yeah, I know. I have sucked at it over the years, to be honest, especially with Mish and you know, with her dad, and even recently I was in WA with my whole family. There were 17 of us, and I was still, you know, saying, hey, guys, sorry, I can't go and do that for a couple hours. Like, I've got to sit here and do this new business proposal pitch because it's really important. So I need to get better at that. But holidays, I absolutely do love holidays. Overseas holidays have always been a favourite of mine past few years. Obviously couldn't do those. So did discover some really nice places around Australia as well as a result of that. Like, I love Palm Cove. I love Fitzroy Island, Trinity Beach, which are all up just north of Cairns. I was in Perth and Fremantle and Dunsborough like about a month ago, the family trip. Like, there are really beautiful places in Australia. So while I've always been this person that loves to go overseas every time I can take a break, I've also realised that, which sounds kind of crazy, but, you know, there's some really great places to go in Australia, and it doesn't take as long to get there. Big fan of Southeast Asia and Europe as well, and hopefully get back there maybe later this year or next year.
All right, next up, if you weren't doing what you were doing now, if you could have a complete change of career, what would it be? What would you be doing? What would your life look like?
I kind of have two for this. Like, I would be a performer. So growing up, I was always singing, dancing, doing Estedfords, like competing.
It's never too late, Sam.
Shopping centre, talent quest. My sister's always loved to bring that stuff up. I was a performer. I loved it. I think, you know, part of my self-confidence really dipped on that because of, like, being overweight and then having an eating disorder. Also, I was never had the vocal range of a Delta Goodrum or Beyonce or a Mariah Carey. So I knew that there was always going to be a limit to that. But I was, other than that, you know, I was a pretty decent performer, and I absolutely love being on stage. So I look at performers like that. I look at the Super Bowl and you know, Rihanna, and I'm like, oh, like, that is definitely something. If I had more talent and, you know, not that I probably would have been at the Super Bowl, but it was definitely a big passion of mine, is singing and dancing and performing on stage. The other one was being a fashion designer. So it was something I sort of dabbled with towards the end of high school. But I had this whole mindset that, you know, I wouldn't make enough money. I wanted to be a business person. Being a fashion designer was so unpredictable. I never went down that path, and I love fashion. So I think it might be that as well.
Wow, you really put a lot of pressure on yourself as a young person, didn't you? You were really like, no, you got to go make bank. You got to go earn.
A lot of learnings to pass on to my daughter.
Yeah. She can go and be the creative vision and spirit. I am going to drag you out into a karaoke bar and really get to see this in full flight, I think. Didn't know that about you, so there we go.
Well, we do, in our team, we do birthday videos. I don't know, I came up with this crazy thing in COVID, and I was just like, we can't see each other, so we're all going to make these singing videos for each other and surprise. Well, the first one was a surprise for the team member, and send it to them and sing. And now I'm the only one that still sings happy birthday in these videos. Everybody else just talks. So I'm not particularly good, but I'll put myself out there for everyone to have a laugh.
I will be expecting to receive one of these with a choreographed dance routine for my birthday this year. Thank you very much. Sure. That is my one request. Okay, what's the best piece of career advice you've ever been given?
Delegate. Don't be the bottleneck. Otherwise, you'll never grow. You'll never scale. Your opportunities will be limited. And it's, you know, again, it sounds so obvious and it's something that I'm getting better at. Really was terrible at it in the early days of businesses. And you know, as a business founder, you know this. Mm. It's hard to let go. It's hard to see other people do things and go, oh, I bet that they got that. Or I could have just, nah.
Yeah.
You've got to delegate. You've got to, the best business people, the best entrepreneurs, learn how to set up systems and processes and delegate. And I remember you saying to me, like, you know, otherwise we're going to be bottlenecks in our business. So best piece of career advice I would say is that one.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? It's so hard to perfection is the enemy of good enough, right? Like it's, you've got to get out of your own way, but it is so hard to just go, oh, look, you know, it's 70% okay, fine, can go out the door. What's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
So originally I came up with something and my team thought it was really boring and I tested it on them because I was like, oh, am I being like too
like
normal?
Was it the singing
me?
Birthday video? Because it's not a bad idea.
No, well, I've already given that one away. No, I was like, hey, what do you guys think? Like, should I just say like people will be surprised to learn that I was school captain in high school? And it was just like crickets. Like, and like, try again. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, all right. Yeah, boring. So not sure if this is any better, but I was at my grandmother's house on the weekend. We were cleaning up stuff and getting all our old school things. And my sister reminded me, she found this old plaque which said that I was a qualified black belt in Taekwondo. And I was like, wow, oh, I've forgotten all about cool. that. So maybe that's cool. I don't know.
That is very cool. I didn't know that about you. That's very cool.
I'm not sure if I could use it now.
Yeah, I won't fight you now. I won't cross you.
Just tell everyone so that they stay away from me. So they're
Exactly. So to finish off, obviously the podcast is all about influence. What is the one tip you have for people who have influence?
Don't shy away from it. Embrace it and use it in a way that you feel proud that you're in that position to be able to have positive impact on others. I've interviewed quite a few people and asked that question, and sometimes people get a little bit like shy or embarrassed and say, you know, I'm not sure that I'm qualified. Do I have influence? But they do. They wouldn't be on this podcast if they didn't. And, you know, most of us have influence in some way, shape or form. It doesn't matter if it's over millions of people or thousands of people or, you know, hundreds or even a couple of people. Yeah. But just don't shy away from it. Like actually embrace it and go, I'm going to do something good with this.
Thank you so much. And thank you for allowing me to hijack your show and host today. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. You know I love a captive audience and a microphone. And it's been such a pleasure sharing some of your story. And I really cannot thank you enough for sharing so openly and so many of those experiences. And I just wanted to reflect on the fact that I do think you are one of the most incredibly tenacious and driven and hardworking women that I know and fearless business leaders of both genders that I know. So thank you for being such an extraordinary person and friend.
Well, thank you. Thanks for making the time, for saying all those wonderful, lovely things about me and actually making the interview very, very easy. If anybody listening to this podcast, I actually interviewed Taryn in season one. I encourage people to go back and listen to season one, but maybe I should. It was quite raw and quite different to these days. But yes, Taryn was a guest. I think it was episode 3 or 4. So you can find her there. But where else can people find you and connect with you and your businesses?
LinkedIn, Taryn Williams, look me up. I'm on Instagram, Taryn Williams as well. My businesses are Wink Models, The Right Fit and Hash Gifted. So you can find them all online. So yes, please do connect, reach out.
And thanks to all of you listening. I hope you got something out of that. It was fun to do something a little bit different. If you want to connect with me, you can find me on LinkedIn. My email is samantha@theprhub.com.au. We'll pop it in the show notes as well. Until next time, see you then.
The Influence Unlocked podcast was presented by Samantha Dyback, CEO and founder of The PR Hub, and executive producer Andrew Menzel from Piccolo Podcasts. Want to connect with Samantha? The links to her LinkedIn and Instagram accounts are in the show notes.